It's Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today we celebrate Thanksgiving 2011. We're feasting with a dynamite menu that's light on the wallet with wines to match. An expert in table talk triage comes by, so hopefully there's no more of those moments when you wish you could go home and realize you are home. We go to Washington, D.C. to the National Museum of the American Indian to taste the food of the original Americans. We have a dissertation on the deliciousness of the giblet, and we're taking your calls. So stick around. A lot's happening this hour on the Splendid Table. This is the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There's one place in Washington, D.C. that's been on my must-go list for far too long. It's a museum cafeteria called the Mitsutam Cafe. And finally, I got there. Now, the cafe is in the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, and that's the giveaway as to why I had to go. Mitsutam has the food of Native Americans, and what food it was. Now, granted, some of the dishes were reaching out to contemporary tastes, but what I had been missing, like snapping turtle soup, wild mushroom corn pone, sweet bean cake with pawpaw pudding, red corn with smoked trout. There were even grilled lamb hearts, and they were tender. They melted in your mouth. Well, Richard Hetzler is the man who makes all of this happen. He's executive chef of the cafe, and I got to meet up with him in his kitchen. Richard, thanks so much for having us here.
No problem. Thanks for being here.
So how does it... You come into the cafeteria, and it's not divided by tribes. It's divided... Well, you explain. How is it divided?
It's divided by region. So basically, we represent the Western Hemisphere's food. You start off in South America, so we cover all of South America. All of North America broken down into three regions. We have the Great Plains, the central part of the United States, Northern Woodlands, which is the Chesapeake's area, and then we have Northwest Coast, California up to the tip of Alaska, and then going down into Central America, all the way down into Mexico and down from there. We've kind of taken, you know, the step of not trying to be authentic Native American, but use indigenous products from those regions that we represent and put them together in a way that work more for the everyday consumer.
Well, if we think about going back to, I mean, these really are the foods of the Americas.
Correct.
Are those foods still in existence? Are Native peoples still eating the foods of their ancestors, or are they gone? Or are they completely blotted out by what's happening now?
No, I think in some ways they have, but I think in a lot of ways there's been a rebirth, you know, within the Native communities that they're really trying to go back to their roots and start to eat the foods that their ancestors did, because if you notice, like diabetes and, you know, the health effects that have happened to Native Americans that weren't there prior to the introduction of the foods pre-contact, or, you know, once they were put on the reservations. So there's kind of been a resurgence within these Native communities in Indian country to revive these old traditional foods and start eating the way that they used to eat in the days past.
There is a pan here that's filled with dark, dark purplish black. Well, they look like corn kernels.
It is, and there's, you know, hundreds of varieties of corn that are grown. Native Americans, you know, were the first to really start harvesting corn. So this is actually a purple corn. It's used a lot in South America. Use it for like Maserata Morado. They make a corn kind of stew or porridge with it. It's for a dessert. They'll add cinnamon and nutmeg and dried fruit to it and make almost like a pudding out of it.
And so you're doing, this is in water. So you're going to soak this and do
this
what?
This has actually already been cooked.
Right.
So this is going to be going into a salad that we're doing, that we're starting on the fall menu. Because our menu changes every 3 months, we change it so often, we're really able to find one-off things that you wouldn't get to use. Chola buds from the Toca tribe in Arizona, you know, sorrel cactus syrup, sorrel cactus seeds, that they're literally growing for their communities, and anything that's left over, they're able to sell. And then we get to do a lot of stuff and procure, you know, these items that most chefs wouldn't get to see.
You've got to clue me in. What's a chola bud?
Chola bud is actually the bud off a sorrel cactus. It actually looks almost like the top part of an asparagus, and they take and dry them out. And basically, they're real fine little specks and stuff on them. So basically what they do is they use sand to get all the pricklies off of them.
Right.
And then dry them out. And then you use them in soup. You can use them in stews and things of that nature. They're very high in potassium, so they're very good, very healthy for you.
Thanksgiving is a very controversial holiday for Native Americans because it signals the entry of the white man onto the continent. How does the Smithsonian and this museum deal with it?
The way I look at it and the way I think we look at it from the food service aspect of it is it's a bringing together of people. I think, there's definitely controversy behind what's happened and what happened after the first Thanksgiving. But I think the underlying piece is it was bringing people together and bringing people into a community and a family kind of setting. And I think that's kind of how we look at it. And we figure out how we use food to kind of bridge that gap and bring people to smile and have fun together no matter what's happened in the past or what's going to happen in the future. It's a way for everybody to kind of connect.
Of the people you've worked with in these different communities, which have opened your eyes?
There's been a lot. We had a chief out here from British Columbia that did kited salmon with me. And I think,
what is this?
It's basically kited salmon is a traditional way that Native Americans would have cooked salmon. Like if you notice upstairs in our cafe, we actually take the sides of salmon. We actually kind of tie them to a cedar plank and actually cook them over the fire.
Right.
Native Americans,
right.
What they traditionally would have done was they would have had a cedar tree, a small one about 2 to 3 inches around. They split them down the middle. And they would take the whole salmon belly side in, slide it through the plank, and then use basically shims to kind of hold it open and stick it by the fire. And they would cook hundreds and hundreds of salmon this way during the runs. So we had brought a chief in from British Columbia. He brought his sticks in, and we cooked salmon by the fire one day. And it was out at the fire pit here, and we did demo and fed, hundreds of people salmon and stuff. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. I think the biggest thing I think I've learned is just how heartfelt most Native Americans are. There's not a grudge that's there. They're not, walking around going, oh, we hate this. We're so mad at that. For them to be able to be represented in the way they are here with food really goes above and beyond. And to be able to really showcase the products that they pretty much brought to the Americas, the potatoes, the corns, the beans, the squash, these key ingredients that really changed the history of food for all these other countries that, might not have known if Native Americans weren't the first to actually cultivate them and bring them to what they were when the Europeans settled. I think the biggest piece to me, and being a chef, I think you kind of have an understanding of food and where food comes from. But I think what I've learned more from this is the true meaning of food and how food is kind of how food started and where it's come and how much Native Americans really played an instrumental role in what food is today.
This is opening up a whole new world for you, isn't it?
It really has. I mean, like I said, being a culinarian, most chefs are lucky enough to be in one restaurant and do one type of food. I'm in a restaurant where we get to do every type of food there is, from ceviches, to moles, to, cedar plank salmon, to, buffalo duck burgers. I mean, we really get to get the best of everything.
Richard, happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Executive chef Richard Hetzler is author of the Mitsutam Cafe Cookbook. Now you can find his recipe for roasted sunchoke salad right on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, Mitsutam means let's eat in the native language of the Delaware and Piscataway peoples. Well, while you're on the site, check out our podcasts, recipes, our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and register for our monthly cookbook giveaway. This month, the book is Essential Pepin from that master of French cuisine, Jacques Pepin. So register on the website, splendidtable.org. When it comes to that dining category that you rarely see on rating sites, small town cafes and diners, well, Jane and Michael Stern are the original experts. They manage to find the best of the lot, and they tell all on their road food site and here. Jane, Michael, hi guys.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn.
So any place that's Thanksgiving appropriate for us this week?
I would spend Thanksgiving and the other 364 days of the year, if I could, in a restaurant called The Farmer's Kitchen. in Atlantic, Iowa. Now, Atlantic is a small town, not too far from I-80 for anyone just zooming through Iowa. But the Farmer's Kitchen is, in some ways, the classic small-town cafe. But it's better than that, because the people who run it, Mark Johnson and his mother, Charlene, are stupendously good cooks. And they go out of their way to make great Iowa specialties even better. I mean, what we think of when we think of an Iowa specialty, for example, is the pork tenderloin sandwich. And there are a lot of great tenderloins throughout Iowa. But at the Farmer's Kitchen, it is thicker, it is juicier, it is served on a locally baked roll, the condiments are extra special, and the whole experience is, like, I want to call it almost the platonic version of an Iowa tenderloin.
But it's not just sandwiches. I mean, they're Michael's a sandwich guy. I'm more of like a, you know, a hot plate lunch person. And they had, I guess this is why it seems Thanksgiving to us also. When we were there last month, I had an open hot turkey sandwich with the best sage stuffing or dressing, however you want to call it, that I've ever had in my life. And I am a stuffing connoisseur.
And of course, it wouldn't be Thanksgiving without a really good piece of pie for afterwards. Now, I'm not sure if Charlene, who is the pie baker there, makes a pumpkin pie or a traditional apple pie. But what she does make is what is called a chocolate peanut butter explosion pie that actually won the blue ribbon in an all-Iowa pie baking contest a couple of years ago. Now, Iowa is a big pie state, and to win the blue ribbon there is serious stuff.
That is very serious.
Yes, but so delicious. I mean, I can't even describe it's a multi-layered peanut butter chocolate fudge on, of course, a crust that is so fragile it just kind of fragments the moment you poke it with a fork. I mean, it's just, it's like I said, it's like better than the ideal.
I think, Michael, you're a traitor, because to us, Iowa for years was sour cream raisin pie.
Oh, yes.
And when I saw you not order sour cream raisin pie there, even though they have the best of the best.
They do.
I was a little let down. But that's okay, because then I ate all the sour cream raisin pie myself.
No, that is an Iowa and maybe Wisconsin and Minnesota specialty that you find rarely anywhere else. But I have to say that Charlene's is maybe one of the top two that I've ever tasted.
I can see people leaving their turkey in the oven and just taking off for Iowa.
Yes.
I would. It's, you know, heartland food in the heartland, in what has to be the quintessential small-town road food cafe.
And I have to say that Mark and Charlene are just these adorable, just homey, folksy, humble, but oh-so-talented proprietors.
Thank you, guys. And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Bye.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the brains and the discerning appetites behind roadfood.com. We'll be back with our latest Thanksgiving menu and the expert on the art of conversation, a handy thing for families gathering on Turkey Day. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Let me set a scene for you. The turkey's in the oven. Your place looks good. You've got a bunch coming over who enjoy each other. You're imagining the good buzz around the table. Then the phone rings. 2 minutes later, you also have your pal's ex-girlfriend and her daughter, Ms. Antisocial Senior and Junior, and her lovely but half-deaf mother joining the crew. Typical Thanksgiving mix. Conversation tends to get a tad fraught, but I have got Daniel Menaker coming to the rescue. Daniel's the author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Daniel, good to have you back with us.
Nice to be here again.
So, in situations like this, what are the best icebreakers?
Well, I think, there's no great wisdom here. There are no secret real tricks that work every time. But I think the tried and true methods, I would add to them a number of other possibilities. One, If the people really don't know each other, but they all know the host, one way of handling it, if you're sitting next to somebody whom you don't know, is to say, how do you know this disreputable person who's giving this party? How did you come to be associated with such low company? Now, that's a joke, but in a way, if you actually say that, I'm not suggesting it just to be a wise guy, but if you say something a little bit mischievous like that,
right?
If you have that kind of sense of humor, if you don't have it, don't try it, because it'll lead nowhere. But if you have a little sense of mischief, it will lead to a sense of connection or bond right away.
Right.
And then I cannot tell you how often and how easily that leads to a closer conversation and one that has more detail and more sort of connections. And it keeps it neutral. It keeps it, it you don't have to become personal right away. You're talking about how you come to be together, which is really the main thing you want to know. How does this group fit? Even though it seems so separate and disparate, there must be some unity in it. And I think one way of starting a conversation is trying to discover what that unity is.
How do you feel about suggesting a topic of conversation for your guests?
Well, I think it does work for a while, although if you have more than four people, my mathematics, my arithmetic tells me that it's very hard to sustain a single conversation for very long. Once you get to five and six, to say nothing of seven and eight, you begin to break down into separate conversations.
Yeah.
But yes, I am in favor of that. When there is a difficult silence, if you can possibly pick up on something that someone else has already said and make it a table-wide question, such as, you know, Jim was talking about going to work yesterday and how difficult he finds it. I just wonder, who's the worst boss you ever had? And people will jump to that almost every time. And I think that those superlatives, like, you know, best vacation, worst travel experience, that's a great one. You can't miss with it. And I think you'll find that then what happens is it's almost like a square dance. Everybody gets together, joins hands, circles to the left, circles to the right, and then you kind of break down into individual couples. You swing your partner, you swing the corner, and there's a kind of rhythm to it.
So, Danny, what do you do when you have the conversation hog? How do you handle that kind of situation?
Well, it's very hard to handle people who are chronically conversationally difficult because the fact is they wouldn't be chronically conversationally difficult if they weren't chronically conversationally difficult. I know an art critic who loves to hold forth and will go on forever. And I've been to somebody's house where he often appears at the same table, and I've actually heard the host say, you know, that's enough. Or, you know, I'd love to know what Dan thinks about that. I mean, my feeling is that 5 minutes is a real limit. I just decided that arbitrarily. If you go on for 5 minutes at a dinner party, unless you're urged to continue in a way that you consider sincere, I would sort of stop. And how you handle them, you interrupt. And one way of interrupting is to pick up on something to show that you've been listening to this bloviator, to pick up on something that he or she has said earlier on and try to turn it into a more general conversation or break away from his, you know, oration. Because that's, in a way, a little more courteous.
Right. What about that long lull? Silence is one thing, but, you know, when the table just goes dead. Like now.
I know. That was my point. I just wanted the listeners to realize how embarrassing that can be. I mean, you talk about a conversation hog. If there isn't a genuinely live wire, which is not the same thing at the table, then it's very difficult to break those silences. But again, it's a matter of social responsibility. You know, unfortunately, when you grow up, almost everything is work. And if you're not willing to do your part in the work, and I hate to think of it that way, but it's true, then you may have an incurable silence. And I think that during those silences, most people, responsible people, are thinking, you know, what can I say? How can we get out of this? What can I say next? And someone will come up with something.
Daniel, thank you. And by the way, happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you, and thanks very much.
Daniel Menaker's written A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Can you imagine what's expected of this man when he sits down at a dinner table? You want a bear of an assignment? Be the one to pick the wines for Thanksgiving, because the days of that simple turkey with a few simple sides, they're gone. We like high flavors, and we're eating in so many languages, like your mom's pierogies next to your turkey mole experiment. That's impossible. But I think that Heather John Fogarty is up to it. She has the Foodinista blog and writes about wine for magazines. Heather, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be here.
Are you up for it?
Let's see.
No, because I think probably Thanksgiving is the most disorganized meal for at least some of us of the year.
Well, it's somewhat, if you're looking at the flavors, it can sometimes be a little schizophrenic. And then you have all those personalities around the table mixed in to boot. So, it's something of a challenge to pick out wines for this meal.
I want to ask you how you go about this as a pro, but I'm going to throw another thing into this mix, bigger challenge. How do you do this with a thin wallet?
Well, that's the thing. If you're having a big Thanksgiving feast, buying wine for the meal can get very, very expensive. You know, one of my favorite wines to start the meal off is a sparkling wine from Spain. It's called Cava, and Cristalino makes a great one. You can get it for, I don't know, $8 a bottle, certainly under $10. And it's a great pairing with all those rich flavors. It's clean, it's crisp, it's got some green apple flavors in there, and it's a real crowd pleaser.
Oh, that sounds, $8 a bottle is going to certainly do it. So where would you go from there with everything that's on the table?
Well, I think it's nice to have a mix of reds and whites, because some people really feel strongly about their reds with Thanksgiving. I might be someone who gravitates more towards white wines, particularly crisp wines that can balance all those big, rich flavors that are on the table. You know, the common misperception is that big, oaky, rich Chardonnays belong at the table. And for my money, I'd rather see something a little lighter that can go with all of these rich foods, like maybe a Chardonnay from a cooler climate like the coast or in Burgundy in France. One of my favorites is a $10 bottle from Joseph Drouin in Burgundy, the La Forêt Chardonnay, and you can find this at many wine stores. It's very crisp. It has some sort of almond notes that are wonderful with the flavors on the table.
Well, that sounds great. So where would you head for the red?
Perhaps Italy.
Right.
One of my favorite finds from Sardinia is Nero d'Avola, and that is the grape. One of my favorite bottles I can find at my local wine store for about $8 a bottle. And it's very smooth and flavorful, sort of like a Pinot Noir. But again, it's got these sort of roasted almond flavors, pistachio, black currant. It's fabulous.
Would you go for a dessert wine, or is that an overkill?
I personally feel it's overkill, but there are some great dessert wines that would be good with maybe apple-flavored desserts, but for pumpkin pie, all I want with that is a little whipped cream.
Instead of the wine. What about the people who say, I'm sorry, I don't want any of these wines. I really think it's an American feast, and I want to go for American wines.
Well, you know, I grew up in Napa Valley, so my family has very strong opinions about American wines on the table, and I'm all for it. a little further up the coast in Oregon, one of my favorite wines to serve at Thanksgiving, my sister's favorite wine, is a Ponzi Tavolo Pinot Noir. And you can find this for around $20 a bottle, so it's at the upper end of our price range, but it is so soft and with beautiful sort of red fruit coming through and more of a medium-bodied Pinot, so it's wonderful.
Heather, that sounds really doable. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
You can find Heather John Fogarty's Thanksgiving wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org, and on that very same website is our 2011 Thanksgiving menu. Some of the dishes are from our new book, How to Eat Weekends, like the gingered puree of winter roots and five-nut caramel tart. Now, for those of you not into turkey, we've conjured a golden biryani of roasted winter vegetables and cashews. And it's vegan, by the way. And this year's Big Bird, well, it's roasted with 40 cloves of garlic. And if I do say so myself, it's delicious. Find our entire spice-scented Thanksgiving menu on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, don't forget to join us live on Thanksgiving Day for Turkey Confidential. Thanksgiving is the only time of year that giblets get any attention. Now, the rest of the year, we buy a chicken, and then we take that little bag of giblets, and we go, ick, and we drop it in the garbage. Well, if you listen to Canadian food writer Jennifer McLaughlin, your tossing days are numbered. Odd Bits is the name of her latest book, and the subtitle says it all, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal. We have Jennifer on the phone from Paris. You poor soul, Jennifer. It's good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you, Lynn, and I'm pretty happy to be in Paris.
Yeah, I would be too. I would be too. Well, okay, giblets come with the turkey in a paper bag, but why don't you explain exactly what's in that bag?
Yeah, it depends. You know, usually what we find in that bag is like the internal organs of the poultry, right? The heart, the liver, the kidneys, if we're lucky, and the gizzard, and probably, maybe not in the bag, but floating around inside the bird, there is its neck. You know, in olden days, they actually had the wingtips and the feet in there, as well as the head, and that made up the giblets, but no longer today. It's kind of an interesting word, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Where does that word come from, speaking of the olden days?
It actually comes from an old French word, giblet, which means game stew, because that was a very popular thing to do with giblets, like to make a stew out of them or to cook them up and make a sauce to put the rest of the birds in that you'd shot in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of flavor and taste in those pieces, those odd bits, and so it's a shame to waste them. I really think we should be using them.
Yeah, because I think of all of them that you throw away through the year, you could really stockpile them.
Well, yes, I think that's true, because I think it's only at Thanksgiving we think about doing something with them, like making a gravy. But the rest of the year, exactly what you said, we put our hand in there and go, yick, and drop it in the garbage.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could put that heart and the liver and the gizzard, separate them out and put them in the freezer. And if you cook a bird once a month or something, you'd have a little collection in 6 months, and you could do something else with them. You know, you could make a kebab with the hearts. You could just saute the chicken livers. Or, you know, my favorite thing with the gizzards, because it's a tougher piece of meat, is to confit them.
Explain this. Now, this is, I've had these, and I was amazed. Explain how you do this.
It's really simple. You just sprinkle them with some salt and leave them for a day or two. And you can have some herbs and spices in that salt, or bay leaves and thyme and peppercorns. And then you just put them into a pan and you cover them with duck fat. Of course, duck fat makes everything taste better. And then you cook them just very, very gently, because they're kind of tough, until they're meltingly tender. And then you can leave them in that pan of fat and then just pluck them out and eat them like that. Or you can sauté them and put them on top of a salad, which the French love to do all the time. They call it gésier, and there's always a salad of gésier on every bistro menu.
And if I remember, this is a very old way of storing them, because you can then just layer them and keep them covered in the fat
and put them in a cool place, and you can keep them for months.
Exactly. That's what most confit was. It's a way of storing these pieces of meat for a long period of time. And once it's completely sealed in the fat and it stays in a very cold spot, it will keep for 6 months or up to a year.
Okay, but let's go back to the turkey. How do you do a giblet gravy?
Well, what I like to do is I take those pieces out and I put them in a pan with a pot with a little duck fat and sauté them. Usually I take the liver out separately because I'm not sure if it's an old wives' tale, but, you know, people say the liver can make the stock a little bitter, and I like to just sauté the liver in butter and put it on a piece of toast while I'm cooking, right, and eat it that way. So I sauté those other bits, the neck and the heart and the gizzard, and then I add some chopped vegetables, you know, a standard kind of mirepoix, which is usually onions and celery and carrots, mm-hmm. just chopped up. And once all that starts to stick to the bottom of the pan, you know, I put a splash of wine in, or if I don't have any wine, a splash of vermouth or something, and deglaze the pan, and then cover those pieces with water and simmer that away on the side of the stove while my bird's roasting. And then I strain it, and I use that as the stock to make my pan gravy because I like to use the juices that have come out of the bird in the pan. And, you know, I would just tip out the fat and keep it for something else, of course. I wouldn't throw it away. And I'd pour in that strained kind of stock, not really a stock, a broth I've made with the giblets, and, you know, deglaze the pan and cook that down and make a fabulous gravy to go with my bird.
If the giblets have a deep, rich flavor that really doesn't equal, I mean, nothing really surpasses that.
Exactly. They give it a depth that can't really be matched, and it's just such the perfect way to do. You know, sometimes I wouldn't even put the neck in there. I might just roast my turkey neck along with the bird because, for me, that's one of the best parts to eat.
And usually there's no competition for it. Have you noticed that?
Well, I have a couple of friends here in France. You've got to be quick to get the neck of any bird. That's the first thing they go for.
Well, Jennifer, I know that you celebrate Thanksgiving in Canada in October, so a belated happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, Lynn, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Jennifer McLaughlin's book is Odd Bits, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal. Well, to really show off those giblets, you should try her confit of giblets. It's up on the website, splendidtable.org. And on the site, you can also find my foolproof turkey gravy guide. Lumpy, wimpy gravy will be banished forever. Check it out. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is now ready to go. The question is, what happened to British turkeys' feet in the 1700s? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The Splendid Table is supported by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. And by Cabot Creamery, a 1,200 farm family dairy cooperative valuing community, quality, democracy, and local ownership. Producing naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese with recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. Well, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email, or you can actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we connect, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. And the question was, what happened to turkeys' feet in England during the 1700s? This is pretty arcane. Anyway, this tidbit is from the University of Illinois' extension site. Farmers sometimes put little booties on turkeys' feet to protect them. You see, they walked flocks miles to market in London. The original turkey trot, anybody?
Are you going on Thanksgiving Day to those family celebrations? Passing on knowledge.
is at the gathering of generations. Every year it's the same routine, all over, come on over, it's Thanksgiving Day.
It is time for your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Marita is on the line from Portland, Oregon. Marita, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I am wanting to get a jump start on cranberry sauce. I've been lazy about that in the past Thanksgivings and opened a can of whole cranberries. So I'm calling to find out some suggestions about a good homemade cranberry sauce, a little tartness, and just a slight bit of sweetness.
Okay. I know what you mean, because the other thing that always happens to me is either it gets forgotten about in the last minute, I run around trying to make it, or I've made it ahead and I find it in the refrigerator the next day.
That's right.
Yeah, which isn't a bad thing, because it's a great thing to spread on sandwiches, but still. Okay, a little tartness, a little sweetness. Do you like a little spice? You know, a little, shall we do a little cinnamon and nutmeg and that kind of thing?
That would be good.
Okay, let's have some fun with it, because you're working ahead. And, you know, cranberry sauce can keep like 7-8 days in the refrigerator. So you can really do this ahead. Yeah, exactly. Let's do this. Why don't you brown some onion and a little bit of oil, add some garlic, like a couple of cloves, and if you have a coffee grinder, okay, or a mortar and pestle, clean out the coffee grinder and grind up some cinnamon sticks and some allspice and black pepper. Not a lot of black pepper, but, you know, a fair amount of cinnamon stick and a fair amount of allspice. And you stir that in once the onion is brown, and then you've added the garlic, and the garlic's cooked for a minute or so, and stir that in until you can really smell it, okay? Uh-huh. And then what you're going to add is just a pinch of hot red pepper flakes.
Okay.
And then you will add, okay, the proverbial orange rind that everybody adds, you know, the grated orange zest, okay?
Yeah.
And then you'll add your fresh cranberries. And for every 2 cups of cranberries, you want maybe a half a cup of sugar.
Okay.
And you want probably about 1/4 cup of vinegar.
Uh-huh.
I'd start with a couple of tablespoons. You can always add more.
Okay.
And a little bit of water. Just enough water to barely cover. And I would just let that simmer until the cranberries begin to pop. And, you know, they have a lot of pectin that's going to get really thick, and you can always thin it with a little water. And then I would taste it, and I'd see if it's – was it sweet enough? Was it tart enough? Do I want to add more? Do I want more spice? Just remember, when you add those things, cook it a little bit longer so they don't taste raw. And you want – of course, you want salt in there as well.
Not only sounds – like it tastes good. It sounds like it looked pretty, too.
Oh, it's going to be beautiful. And make a fair amount, because first of all, it freezes well. And it can do a rerun. But secondly, this is one of the great sandwich spreads of all time. Not to mention what happens, you know, when you daub it on the side of the plate when you're having, you know, any kind of meat or fish. Or you know what it's wonderful with? You toss it with hot steamed cauliflower and a little butter.
Oh, wow.
I have to tell you, the cauliflower starts looking like gems.
Ah.
And it's really gorgeous. It's really pretty. It's a great combination. So give it a shot. Okay.
Well, thanks a lot, Lynn.
Hey, and happy Thanksgiving.
Okay, you too.
Bye. Kirsten is calling from Santa Cruz. Kirsten, what is on your mind? Hello.
I have always kind of hated Thanksgiving turkey. It's kind of my least favorite part of Thanksgiving. But about 10 years ago, I was at my husband's family reunion, and his aunt and uncle made a spectacular smoked turkey that I actually liked. And I was hoping to try to smoke a turkey myself this Thanksgiving, but I'm a little intimidated wondering if you had any advice about smoking turkeys.
Okay, I have to tell you, it has been many, many a moon since I have smoked a turkey. The key with smoking a turkey, though, is that you have to do it low and slow, and you have to get, you want an instant reading thermometer, okay? And you want to know that the center of the breast gets to 170 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the real key. And what I would do is I'd go to the experts. I'd go to the Weber website.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're going to have some of the best recipes.
Awesome.
Yeah, they're going to have the goof-proof techniques. And the other site that's really going to be dynamite to check out a whole bunch of recipes is going to be Epicurious, because they generally have recipes from Gourmet Magazine and from Bon Appetit Magazine. And those are two entities that test their recipes like crazy. What you want to avoid when you go looking for recipes are generally those first pages you get.
Right.
Because they're generally, you know, it's very enthusiastic cooks, but they're not pros. and you know, you waste all your time and all your ingredients, and then you say, but it didn't come out right. Well, that's because sometimes people don't do a lot of testing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Generally, the key to smoking something big like a turkey is, A, do not stuff it.
Okay.
Brine it ahead. Figure an hour in brine for every pound of turkey.
Okay.
And there are lots of good brine recipes out there. And keep it cold when you brine it.
Right.
But close to room temperature when you start to cook it.
Okay.
Okay. The brining is going to keep it moist.
Great. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Have a great holiday.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Reach us, 800-537-5252. By the way, I have done a turkey guide that is from essentially heritage birds right down to that plain old supermarket bird. It breaks down what those are and what's worth the money. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Tara's calling from Asheville, North Carolina. So, Tara, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. My question concerns side dishes for a Thanksgiving meal where the main entree is not turkey.
Uh-huh.
My brother's going to cook a suckling pig, and we may also have a turkey breast to keep the traditionalists happy. But I wondered if you had any suggestions as far as veggies and other side dishes
that
would complement the piglet.
Okay, side dishes. How traditional is the family? I mean, are there dishes that the family has to have?
I think we're going to have it's a cranberry relish with crystallized ginger and orange marmalade. But other than that, they're used to being guinea pigs. So
okay, all right. Because what I'm thinking is it would be kind of fun to have, you know, Brussels sprouts that you roast with something like really smoky bacon. You're in the part of the country that would have great bacon, a little bit of the bacon. And a little bit of tamarind, which is sour and fruity. And you could cut the Brussels sprouts in half, and you have bits of the bacon, and you would have some onion, and you would have a teeny bit of brown sugar, just a little to balance, and olive oil and salt and pepper. And then you'd have a tablespoon or so of tamarind concentrate, if you can get it. If you can't, then you would use grated lime or lemon rind.
I actually have some in the refrigerator.
You
so.
Do. And you can just baste it with a little bit of the pan juice from the pig. And you would roast that off in the oven. And then I think the other thing is you want something bright and fresh and green. And I'm thinking that steamed broccoli that you serve at room temperature. And to top it, saute a mess of thin sliced red onions with olives and a little bit of tomato. And garlic. And you heap that on the spears of the steamed broccoli. And you just finish that off with salt and pepper and maybe a little chili. And so, again, you're playing against that. The suckling pig is the star, and that crystallized ginger cranberry. I mean, that would be beautiful. And very simple mashed potatoes with that. Everybody wants simple mashed potatoes.
That's true.
You know, there's no question about simple mashed potatoes.
That sounds wonderful. I think I'm hungry.
I think it's going to be a good Thanksgiving. It sounds pretty swell to me.
Thank you so much.
And have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
We have John Mark calling us from Africa. John Mark, hi. Where are you in Africa?
Hi, Lynn. I'm actually in Ouidah, Benin. It's West Africa, the little country, I guess, in between Togo and Nigeria.
And it's called Ouidah, Benin?
Yeah, the country I've been in, the city I'm in, is Ouidah.
I have never heard of it, I'm embarrassed to say.
That's
you'll have to look it up.
Now what?
It's an interesting little place.
What has brought you there?
I'm actually working at the International Center for Art and Music in Ouida. It's a school that promotes arts education in the developing world. So I help to run the school, and we teach music and art to a lot of children in Benin. So actually, if you hear a little bit of noise right now, it's because in the other room there's traditional dance going on. So Ooh. There's always something going on traditional too at Siamo.
Now, do you have a question?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. A Thanksgiving question. In my situation here, we're looking to buy a turkey and slaughter it, but I don't have an oven. So what I do have, I have a lot of cinder blocks. I have access to firewood. I have access to charcoal. And I'm not sure, is it possible to spit roast a turkey, or would it be too dry? I don't know what to do. Pretty much everyone here cooks with either charcoal or firewood.
All right. The key is you want to cook it in front of the heat, not over it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have a spit, and ideally the spit should be made out of metal, because wood obviously could eventually start to burn. Or it should be green wood, because that won't
right.
burn. And essentially you need two forked pieces of, a young tree that you would have pretty sturdy. You'd stick in the ground on either side of whatever the source of the heat is, or you'd build up your cinder blocks. And then
right.
you'd be turning that spit, but you'd have the fire set back. And you'd be doing this
okay.
more or less, where you'd get the cinder blocks really, really hot, and you could lace the spit through the cinder blocks. So essentially, you're creating the heat reflecting off of the cinder blocks, and you have one side open.
Uh-huh.
And you see
okay,
what I'm
see what
saying? And then you could also mm-hmm. have a bed of coals where you could bury potatoes or local sweet potatoes or vegetables, that
mm-hmm.
onions, that kind of things that you can roast to go with them. But I have a feeling you're living in a community of experts in this kind of
okay,
cooking.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Also,
I never thought of
if
it that
you
way.
Want to talk about bringing people together, which is the essence of what the holiday is
mm-hmm.
about, boy, is this a great opportunity. Yeah.
I'm especially curious, because yes, the people here do have, especially for large festivals and parties, they tend to roast maybe a pig or a cow or something like that. But you very rarely see turkey cooked in that way. So I don't, that, is
how
there any difference that I should be aware of to make sure that we don't make any mistakes?
Well, how would they normally cook a large animal? On a spit?
Yeah, usually it's sort of on a spit, just kind of over a fire that lasts a long time. I mean, it's
yeah.
a long process, especially
right.
for those big animals.
So what you want to ask them is to help you to do a miniature version of that. And you want to cook it a long time, and to make sure it's done properly, you don't have any thermometers that you can stick into it to read, do you?
That's something I need to look for, but I could probably find one.
Well, if you could, that would be great. But if you can't, there are two ways you can tell if it's done. One is if you pierce the thigh, and you can take a plate and hold it under the place where you pierce. And if you see the juices are running clear or they're yellow, it's done. If they're pink, it's not. And the
okay.
other thing is if you cut down to the joint of the thigh and where the leg and the thigh meet, or where the thigh meets the body, and it's the meat has any red, it's not done yet.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay? So I think this could be a great community project.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks a lot, Lynn.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Happy Thanksgiving, and until next time, let me leave you with this from William Blake, who said, "When I started counting my blessings, my whole life turned around." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Browse our recipes, our online store, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter and special podcasts, and take a look at our new book, How to Eat Weekends. There's a lot going on, so check it all out. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Getten. Special thanks to Andrew Chadwick for the Smithsonian recording. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.